why are you bad for the economy?
Okay, it started like a joke because I was getting frequent comments from people telling me, after following you on Twitter for a while, I decided to quit my grueling job and, you know, work less and enjoy life more. So, and I'm not joking, I was getting something like this almost every week, right? Somebody in the DMs telling me something similar. And once I tweeted basically this, like, I'm getting these often, I'm becoming bad for the economy. And it sort of stuck a little bit as an insider joke, like, right? People started using it like, oh, I'm also bad for the economy, I did this and that. But I think over time, that statement evolved because I started to realize that there's a common mistake, a misconception, that what is good for the collective is sometimes assumed to be also good for the individuals. And we hear politicians talk, you know, sometimes on both ends, sometimes saying, you know, we should improve the economy, we should grow the economy, blah, blah, blah. And but that doesn't necessarily mean that the people under the economy are necessarily enjoying the growth. In fact, we all know that the economy could be growing, the GDP could be growing, but 99% of the people in that population could be seeing their income or wealth diminishing. It's not inconsistent. It's actually very, very common that it happens. And I started to see this pattern and this sort of misconception almost everywhere. You know, I have a background in software and tech, and for example, people look at Silicon Valley as something that's growing. They measure the number of startup exits and the wealth created by Silicon Valley or by venture capital-backed companies. And they assume sort of that all the individuals or most of the individuals participating in that collective are also benefiting. Whereas the reality is that in the situations, usually it's true that the group is growing, but like most of the times, 99% or even more, 99.9% of the people in that part, in that group are not seeing any payoff. Like sometimes seeing negative income, negative growth, negative wealth or whatever. Right? And the average basically that gets dragged by some freak outliers, which are usually inaccessible by people, you know, in a single lifetime. Right. So I became fond of this idea because first of all, it's not something I discovered myself or whatever, but sort of it started to become very important to me, and I've been sort of trying to share it. And I've adopted it as sort of my tagline on Twitter, right? But it has sort of the original story is like that funny joke, but eventually I think it evolved to something more important and more general that I think more people should reflect on when they examine, you know, the prospects of what they're participating in.
And it's curious that this started as a joke, because a guy who's bad for the economy and a bridge dweller enter into a bar. And yeah. I think, I don't even know how the joke continues, but it's like, yeah. Because in my case, my tagline also now is bridge dweller, mm-hmm. but it started as a joke because I want to bridge the gap between academia and industry. Mm-hmm. I ended up dwelling under that bridge. Then I moved to Salamanca and there's this nice Roman bridge there. So I started taking pictures of it and yeah. It stuck. So, but yeah, I want to kind of push back a bit against that, because I always see your tweets about what you just said, right? The difference between what might be good for the collective is not necessarily good for the individual. And then you might have all kinds of followers, right? They might be inspired. They see you on Twitter, they follow you, and they start seeing your tweets, and they decide, oh, I need to quit, because mm-hmm. that's what I should do.
Yeah.
So, is that kind of a prudent thing to do? Just, you know, if I'm following you now and I think to myself, oh yeah, I have this job, I'm not that happy, well, I might as well quit. Mm-hmm. Is that what you advocate?
No, I sincerely believe that We're all slightly different. You know, I think we're mostly, you know, humans are mostly similar, but we have subtle differences. And I think I generally believe that there are people who are more comfortable in a more structured and environment on the regular daily basis, work arrangements, whatever. And there are others on a slightly different end of the spectrum where this structure wears them out, right? And they can't function properly. I think it's super important for people to discover what their true preference is. And I honestly believe that it's very hard to change your nature, right? It's, you know, if you have a palm tree and you're trying to grow it in Alaska, you can do it, right? You can create a greenhouse, create artificial lighting, control the humidity, control the temperature, control all the variables to make the palm tree survive in a completely different environment. But it's a continuous struggle, because now you need to control everything. It's a very fragile setup, right? Because if the power goes out, your palm tree will suddenly become cold and die, right? If there's a leak or whatever, right? And metaphorically, I think this is what happens to us when we're in the wrong environment. Like, if you're the kind of person who don't like having to ask for permission, working on a schedule, the rigid 9-to-5 frequency, right? The monotonous slog, and you're generally that kind of person, right? Living in a corporate environment is going to wear you out, I think, first mentally and very soon physically, right? Mental health, physical health, and everything. And I don't think it's something, you know, you can just cope long term, right? Because it's harmful probably to you. And I think in that situation, probably the best way is to change your environment. Like the palm tree, the best way for the palm tree to be happy is to take it to a tropical place. But yeah, I think it's important to discover, like, are you a pine tree or a palm tree, right? Or something in between in the spectrum. Because yes, it's not just a binary thing, I'm sure, right? There's tolerance. In fact, I don't think I'm the most extreme. I can tolerate. In fact, I tolerated a structured work arrangement for like 12, 13 years. Until sort of I came to my breaking point. I'm sure there are others who can't even tolerate that much. So I think that's my general message, right? To try to encourage people. And I think what's super interesting to me, coming from tech is one of these probably one of the most prosperous, lucrative professions, certainly in modern times. I don't know if throughout all of human history. It's so sad to be seeing people with so much privilege, so much advantage, so many options. They're so skilled, so highly well paid. They could do so many things and then still get stuck in sort of this lifestyle that they dislike, right? And my anecdotal experience, right, working almost a decade in big tech, has been working with people, right, who seem always unhappy, unsatisfied. They're not in the right place. They're the palm tree in the greenhouse. They're coping. It's a fragile setup. It's very unfortunate. Like, I mean, you have so many options. Why not exercise them? Right? You could probably do something, change your work arrangements. And I think the biggest reason why people don't change is that they measure their life and their professional success through financial metrics. And it's true, it's hard, right? When you're well paid, you have a good job, you have benefits and everything, it's hard to give all that up to do something that's going to very likely earn you more. It feels like almost winning the lottery and not cashing out the whole winnings, right? So, and I'll admit, like, even to me, it was hard, like, to convince myself, especially when you have a family, because it's not just your money, but it's money for my kids, my family in total, right? So you're making a decision for the whole unit. So I'm not saying it's easy, right? But I like encouraging people to reconsider, right? At least, right? And inspiration can be helpful there to see somebody else doing something that you may want to do.
As you worked at just would you have
Mahmoud, you were breaking up. I didn't get anything.
Okay.
You You're still breaking up.
Is it the audio or the video?
The audio. No, no, the audio. You're good now. You're good. It was, I think. Let me say something.
Hello, hello.
Yes, yes, you're good. It was just the audio.
I'm good now. Okay.
You're weird. Good now. Sorry.
Good. So, so no, I was saying, I have a tongue-in-cheek question because I saw your tweet.
Yeah.
Would you have participated in the Amazon because you worked at Amazon?
Oh, certainly not. No, look, I'm not against walkouts or strikes or whatever, but there's a point where it becomes pathetic. It feels to me like you're seeing Wall Street bankers with their suit and tie protesting because and doing a walkout because, you know, they don't like the coffee in their office, something like that. It's so, I mean, these you drive into the Amazon parking lot and it's full of Porsches and Teslas, and these are people with $2 million homes in the mountains, and they're out there with the poster, "I don't want to come." I mean, it's ridiculous, right? So, imagine you're an Amazon warehouse worker, right? I mean, peeing in bottles and sort of working for minimum wage and under harsh conditions, and then you see your manager from the headquarters office protesting outside in the streets of Seattle just because they were told to go to the office. Look, I don't agree with Amazon enforcing managers to go to the office. Like, so I'm with them, with the sentiment. Like, I think it's ridiculous, you know, and they should probably be working from home. But the way it's done is just so it's a lack of dignity, I think. Like, that's probably self-respect, right? And you, again, like, you're so privileged, you're so well paid, you shouldn't be doing this, right? that's the best way I can think of describing it.
Yeah, and they're in a position whereby if they wanted to quit, they can just simply quit.
Exactly, they could quit. They have so many options. There's like recruiters begging them every day. Like, it's a joke. It's a joke almost. It's an insider joke in big tech. Like, so like the recruiters nagging you because they want to give you jobs everywhere, and you're saying no all the time. Right. So you know, it's you're in that position. That we're almost, it's like, again, like it's very bizarre, right? So,
but see, this is a thing. I also know people who are working for big tech, but they still are hesitant to quit. Yeah. People who are also in your community, right? Be the people we have in common who have signed up for my philosophy courses. And they just, so it's, I don't know, does it take, yeah, you did mention, you know, the palm tree metaphor, but as someone who comes from a business and philosophy background, like, I can understand why I would have, I would think twice before I would quit my job, right? But when it comes to software developers and those who code, etc., and engineers who have these skills that are in high demand, right? So you're like, even if things don't go as you plan, eventually you can eventually find another job, right? So you're not going to end up you have a safety net. But then for some reason they might feel hesitant because what if something goes wrong, or what if I don't know, I don't end up, is it,
yeah,
so do you think this is kind of they feel like they're not prepared for, or they don't want this 9 to 5, so is it just a non-rational fear, like some sort of sentiment they have, but then once they take the plunge they might realize that everything is going to be okay, or is there something else that one should have for them to actually make this leap of faith?
No. Look, I think the hesitation is probably good information, right? There's probably a good reason why your subconscious is making you hesitant. And if the prospect of uncertainty and no structure and not having anyone tell you exactly what you should be doing, like, freaks you out, like, scares you, like, if that's the things of nightmares for you, then probably you shouldn't, right? You should try to find some other arrangement, maybe something in between. If you don't like full time, maybe try to, you know, freelance, for example, or part time, or continue full time in a different company, or switch from an office to remote or something like that. I think it's all about discovering our true preferences and trying to arrange our work arrangements in a way that matches our preferences. Right? So it's basically, it's that problem. I think the anxiety and the hesitation, we should listen to them, right? Because they're telling us something. And, you know, not being prepared, I think it's a different thing, right? Because not being prepared, I certainly wasn't prepared, right, to work for myself. I just knew that I had to quit because it would have probably led to a mental breakdown, right? So I sort of, it was almost like, wouldn't say again, like maybe desperation, but almost, right? That I had to do this, and I said somewhere or another I figured it out. But I certainly wasn't prepared. But I think, again, like the negative visualization of me having to go back was the motivation I needed to figure out a way to make it work, right? And I think that's important as well. Like, what is truly important for you? Is it making a lot of money? Is it having some prestigious job title? Is it just, you know, having a very, very predictable paycheck coming in every month? Like, what are the most important things to you, right? And I think, you know, try to derive motivation from those things, right? And make them happy. Like, I was completely okay with giving up like the stability of my income and the benefits and all the other job title nonsense and prestige or whatever. I'm not saying that those things are not completely valueless to me, but sort of it was part of a good trade-off to give up those things and get the flexibility. But then I think I figured out, again, because of necessity, right? I what was killing me the most was having to go back to where I left off, even though, again, I had the safety net. Again, I was never really risking going bankrupt, becoming homeless, or some other harsh situation like that. But I almost mentally wrote off that option completely because I didn't want. There's a saying I heard from a friend who does weightlifting, right? And was telling me that if you're trying to lift these, you know, squats with one rep max, like these very heavy things, you know, this squat structure will have like hinges to protect you, that if you can't lift it, you can put it on the hinges and it won't squash you. And my friend was telling me it's important to forget that the hinge exists, right? Because otherwise you won't activate your full strength. And I think there's something similar here. I think it's important that if you take the plunge and you don't want to go back, you almost need to forget that the safety net exists, right? To activate your full motivation. And otherwise it's very easy to just go back and let yourself fall into the safety net.
Yeah. And in this case, because you mentioned in your course, the small bets one, that sometimes having a cushion kind of hindered you or
yeah. it made me more idealistic.
Disadvantage, yeah.
It made me
coming up with better alternatives.
Because I think what happened, yeah, like, at one point in the beginning, so I was lucky, I managed to save a good amount of savings that would have allowed me to continue to live off my savings for like 4 or 5 years without making any lifestyle changes, which seems like a good, great thing to have. Certainly that's what I thought in the beginning, to have this cushion. But I think what happened to me is that when I took the plunge, I became so idealistic that I was thinking, you know, I'm not going to be dealing with small things here. I'm going to, I have so, this time, I took this big, I made this big change in my life. I'm going to go for my, I build my ideal business, my ideal product. I want to build a company, something sustainable, blah, 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 all that nonsense. Which I think that's a very wrong attitude to take when you're trying to tame the uncertainty of self-employment. I think nowadays, I think if I had a shorter runway, I would have forced myself to go after small wins quickly, because then it became important. It becomes obviously important that the first goal is to pay the bills. The first goal is to survive. And I think this is the key revelation to me, that if you want to take the plunge and you want to jump into self-employment, from day one, you should be asking yourself, how am I going to pay the bills this month? Like, focus. So today we're recording this June 1st, start of a new month. Your first goal should be, I want to make as much money in June, make more money than I spend in June. You do it whichever way you can, of course, you know, within your ethical and principal constraints and laws. and then do the same thing in July and August and whatever. And it becomes easier over time for various reasons, because you start figuring out what works and what doesn't work. Well, what you're good at, what you're not good at. You start building reputation, right? You start benefiting from success, bringing it with it more success. Usually, I see you laughing, like you're disagreeing.
I'm three years into this, and I was kind of forced into it. And you know the story. Well, maybe I don't know if I know what I want to do. And within the coming 6 months, right? But
you were just telling me before we started recording, right? I mean that you're taking a break from philosophy or you're trying to do something different. I think this is part of you learning more about yourself in the current situation, that you're improving your fitness with the environment. And the environment is everything. The market, yourself, your circumstances, like, you know, if for example, you know, having a kid changes your life significantly. Now your circumstances changes. You have limited time. You have dependents who depend on you, right? For example, and you become forced to adapt to that reality, right? And some things that become possible, you might ignore them, and so on and so forth. And that's just family circumstances. Again, it could be the economy, like in your case, like when you left Lebanon and moved to Salamanca, and the economy, the environment, right? You adapt to it, right? And now, I think that's part of it, right? The more you do it, I think it's like a muscle, right? The muscle, you stress it a little bit and it becomes stronger. The more sort of the market changes into small ways, the better you become at fending for yourself. And this is the thing that I still can't articulate it well, and I'm looking for the right way to explain it, but I'm going to try anyway. Like, I feel over the last 4 years or so, I became very good at fending for myself. Like, I've built the enough confidence that I feel like almost no matter what happens, economic changes, hyperinflation, AI taking over the world, zombie apocalypse, world wars, whatever happens, I feel like I will figure out a way to make ends meet. Like, I'll adapt, right? And I sort of built a good sense of finding opportunities and inserting myself into them, and again, not wedding myself to job titles or skills or whatever. And this is something that I think the only way to become good at it is to start taking some risks. You need to start building that risk-taking muscle, dealing with uncertainty, doing things where the payoff is uncertain, right? And then you observe the results and sort of you start to build that part of your brain that's good with fuzzy logic. This is the problem I think I lost when I was an employee. And I think many people who are in the corporate world lose, is the inability to think outside of a spreadsheet. Like, when I was working at Amazon, almost every decision we've made needed to be pros and cons weighted with numbers. Like, even choosing a name for a product, nobody says, let's go with this product, I like it, it gives me a good feeling, whatever. No, you had to go do customer surveys, tally up all the numbers, and then we choose the one that got the most points. Like, nothing was driven by gut, by the subconscious, right? Which is, I believe the subconscious is the smarter part of our brain when it comes to dealing with uncertainty, what we call our gut feel or whatever, right? And I think the only way to strengthen that muscle again, right, that mental muscle, is to start taking some risks, making decisions that you can't do on a spreadsheet, because you can't do it, right? You can't quantify, you can't measure things, you can't even observe everything, right? And you get better at it. Like, you know, like you when you started the classes for philosophy, right? I mean, how do you define, how do you determine what good enough content? How do you determine how many sessions to make? How do you determine what price to set? There's infinite possibilities there. You could have created classes that could have lasted 6 months. You had done one class. They could have been 30 minutes each, 2 hours each, 3 hours. You could have charged $1,000, $50, $500. Like, in the beginning, you're clueless, right? You start, you know, trying or maybe mimicking some other successful product, like as a starting point. And then over time, you start becoming better. You probably already have a feeling of, you know, this price point is probably too high. It will be hard to fill a class if I charge so much, right? And probably if, you know, you start getting this, I like to call it probabilistic knowledge, right? This is not knowledge, that is concrete knowledge, the type of knowledge that we learn, you know, in books or 1 + 1 = 2, that's like concrete knowledge, it's a fact. This is probabilistic knowledge, right? It's likelihoods, unlikelihoods, patterns, and whatever. And I think the only way to build this is just to put yourself out there, take some risks, not necessarily risking something consequential, but just doing something with an uncertain payoff, right? And doing it over and over.
Yeah, in my case, like, for example, this is, yeah, tell me.
No, no, sorry. I was thinking a good example, and that's something I use in my course. Like, imagine our ancestors 10,000 years ago, hunter-gatherers living off the land. Imagine how different the world was. Like, you wake up in the morning, there's no food, you have kids, they're hungry, and you have to go out in the forest to find food. Like, you have no idea where the forest is, like, where the food is. Every step, like, that our ancestors made was a decision under uncertainty, right? It's completely different than the world of today when you receive a steady paycheck round to 2 decimal places every month and you know exactly what the price of butter and milk and bread is at the supermarket, right? And I think this is a skill that we lose just by living a very, very predictable life. Like, our ancestors managed to tame that uncertainty, right? Go in the forest every day and find something, always. Like, otherwise we wouldn't be here. Of course, some of them didn't make it, but many of them did, right? And we're here today, right? And I think there's something probably still in our DNA, right? I mean, we haven't changed that much in the last 300, 400 generations, right? I mean, we're probably still hunter-gatherers at a DNA level. But I think, again, like a muscle that you don't use, it heads off ease away. I think once you live a very steady lifestyle, that part of the brain, you almost lose it.
Yeah, and these are... This is very interesting because you're right. It's we kind of became too comfortable in a way. That's on the one hand when it comes to handling and adapting to uncertainty. And on the other hand, when it comes to things like Amazon and big companies and using spreadsheets instead of relying on gut feeling, I also understand that. And I think this is the problem when it comes to extremes, right? Because we did discuss this before, scale plays an important role. Like when you're mm-hmm. in a place like Amazon and you have many managers and directors and many departments and so many things at stake, right? You have to, yep. Like, this is the most kind of objective way to decide mm-hmm. What to call a product and how to evaluate and get feedback, etc. I feel like this is the only, maybe not only, but one of the main reasons why we do these things. Mm-hmm. And I experienced it firsthand in a startup, at university, archives, like it, and doing my own thing, because you mentioned my classes. When you're alone, the scale is kind of too small, so you can go with gut feeling because you can change things at a whim. Doesn't work this month, you do that. You change the next month within 6 months. I've rebranded like 500 times already over the past 3 years, right? And I'm almost sure you did too with mm-hmm. Twitter, yeah. The AWS book, Twitter, and then mm-hmm. you even dabbled in woodworking and, you know, and now the Small Bets community. So, mm-hmm. so I think it's for those who might be listening to us and who follow you on Twitter and who also maybe sign up for your course, community, etc. I don't. So you're right in using the example of hunter gatherers, etc. But it's not. So I don't think the answer therefore is to just take the plunge, right? As such, it's just the awareness that we are too comfortable, and this is where maybe Hassan comes in as mm-hmm. a middle ground of some sort. Mm-hmm. Hassan Osman, author on the side, because Hassan is the example of someone who And I want to know what you think about this, right? As mm-hmm. as someone who is fit for the structured 9-to-5 job, right? But mm-hmm. then he's aware about the uncertainty, and he doesn't want to just be complacent, kind of, and be too comfortable with his steady paycheck. And that's why he mm-hmm. goes out every day after his job to mm-hmm. kind of look for a possible yeah. for extra food to keep on the side. And that's why mm-hmm. he develops courses, and that's why he develops et cetera. Now, What do you think about that? Because would you say, no, I need to go to the extreme and be constantly alert, to be able to fend for myself and adapt? Or yeah. would you say whatever works for anyone, insofar as they're aware that it's like you can lose your job at any point in time, and then how would you prepare for such uncertainties and events which will happen sooner or later? Or what would you...
I'm certainly not against taking an incremental approach to changing your work arrangements, like having side projects or minor tweaks, right, to make things better. But I think it needs to be balanced with the fact that it's very easy to be trapped into something that and this is again, like, from my experience, my own personal experience, and from people who I know closely who work in tech, that they I know, and this happened to me as well for a few years, that, like, you dislike this, right? You wake up in the morning and you don't really want to go, and like it's Sunday and tomorrow is Monday and you really don't feel like going, and there's all this negative feeling, but then you keep saying, oh, but I just going to wait until I get my next promotion so that I have a stronger resume, or I'm going to wait, I'm so close to getting a pay raise or a bonus, I should wait for it, or now my kids are almost grown up, so I'll wait until they go to college and then I'll take the plunge, or I'm about to have a kid, so I'll wait until the kid is born, so I'll have good health insurance. There's always some excuse, and it's so easy to fall into this. And one of the biggest traps big companies do, at least in the United States, is they tend to give you, especially public companies, big companies, part of your compensation that vests in the future, right? So there's also these psychological traps of, if you leave now, you're going to lose all that money that otherwise you're going to be getting, right, if you just show up for another year or so, right? So there's all these intentional and unintentional traps. I really believe that, again, like, if you're convinced that you discovered that your true preference of how you work is incompatible with your arrangement, probably the best strategy, I'm not going to generalize that in every circumstances, but probably in most situations, the best strategy is to take the plunge and make that work, right? Use the motivation that you have to make it work to make it work, right? I'm like, I don't know Hassan, and I know him, but I don't know him enough to speak on his behalf or what he's really thinking. But I'm almost certain that if he were to take the plunge, he'll figure out a way, right? Because he's capable. He figured out. He's been doing side projects for more than me, right? For over 10 years. He'll probably be making less money than he is, almost certainly, for a long time, right?
I'm not so sure, but now, after 10 years, I think he's capable of making just by giving talks, yeah. I think, and workshops.
Talks, yeah. Consulting, workshops, yeah, like, he's connected, he's skilled, he has the, like, he built his risk-taking muscle, right? So he knows, I think he has a good sense of, this is unlikely to work, this is more likely to work, and sort of improve his odds of success. Like, he's not just throwing random things at the wall. He's in excellent shape. But again, like, maybe it's the type of personality that he enjoys going in the morning, and there's a to-do list, and you need to get to this to-do list, right? And it gets done, and that's it. That, to me, is the opposite. Like, it's just... one of the rituals in software development that I really hated. It's called the daily stand-up, right? And software development teams do this, where, like, at 10 a.m. in the morning, everyone huddles up in a circle and they say, you know, you're supposed to have like 5 minutes to say what you did yesterday, what you're planning to do today, and if there's any blockers. And you go in circles, and that used to kill me because I don't work like that. I don't work in a continuous, monotonous slog. Sometimes I produce 100 times more than my average, and most of the times I'm just thinking, wondering about, don't going nowhere that ends. So I always felt like I had to force myself to come up with something that seems, even though technically it's okay to say I didn't make any progress, whatever. But again, the expectation is that you're making a continuous progress, that you're making that in a 5 week work, 5 day work week, you're making 1/5 progress per day, right, of the target of the week, right?
Yeah,
it's like machines on the assembly line, right? I mean, and I think creative work, knowledge work, rarely works that way. I'm not going to say never, right? But it's very hard to do. But certainly not with my personality, right? I just never work like that, right? I always work when I'm inspiration-driven, opportunity-driven, right? And I just can't make myself work just because it's 10 a.m. and I have to work, right?
Yeah. And see, this is a thing, and I completely agree with you when it comes to, like, on this aspect, because at one point in time, I would... This is just a mindset, kind of. And I know this might be a naive attitude or view of approaching things as well. So I got to a point, maybe this is also the muscle I'm exercising for the past 3-4 years, no? But I think to myself, there's an opportunity there, any opportunity, freelance or anything, right? It could be like writing articles.
Mm-hmm.
And I think to myself, why, like, would I be motivated if I'm writing about mm-hmm. these topics for someone else
mm-hmm.
as a not as a freelancing kind of project, but as a full-time or even part-time kind of thing, continue on a continuous basis? And then I think to myself, but if I can do that, and I would mm-hmm. be much more motivated if I'm writing it on my own, generating my own content, kind of, then why wouldn't mm-hmm. I do it all by myself, right? Why do I have to wait for someone to give me the opportunity just for mm-hmm. them to give me like a paycheck eventually, and that's it? And I'm not talking about, you know, freelancing projects. You do that, like, you know, the design or whatever, you do it and you're done. No, I'm talking about this steady kind of paycheck, $1,000 a month, whereby you do this and that's it. Like, if you can do that for other people, why wouldn't you do it for yourself? Because you're going to be more motivated. You're going to be, you understand how you work. You might leave things to the last minute. No one is going to be bothering you about it. You're going to write the article, because this is what I'm doing now, right? When it comes to my newsletter and now with the podcast and all these things. Will they generate money? I don't care. They might create opportunity. I don't care. Mm-hmm. Am I enjoying my time? Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So this is kind of like, I understand where you're coming from, because I think even if you were doing the same, like if you want to do the same things you are doing at Amazon now, you would be much more motivated doing them on your own.
Yeah, and I would eliminate, you know, all the purposeless stuff, right? That at least purposeless to me. I mean, I'm certainly to somebody there, it wasn't purposeless, but again, it's another thing that used to wear me out. Nobody likes, I mean, no matter how much you're getting paid, working on something you feel it's useless, I think there's different tolerances for this as well. It used to kill me, I'm sure. There's others who tolerate it more, and probably others who tolerate even less than I do, right? Yeah, absolutely. I agree.
Have you done a PhD, by the way?
No, I stopped after my bachelor's. So.
Oh, okay.
I wasn't fit for structured education either.
But that's why I'm asking. So
because actually just even finishing my 4-year degree was I stretched it actually to 6 years, because I failed 1 year and I missed an exam the last year. Yeah, like, and this to be, it's interesting, right? Because this is something I always thought I'm a self-directed learner. I dislike structure completely, right? I mostly learned even programming from books on my own, tinkering at my own pace. And what's funny is that when I heard about the idea of cohort courses, classes like this, initially I disliked them, disliked the idea. Like, why would I attend a live session with somebody and I have to be there at a particular date and whatever? Again, the structure, like, it's insane. and then I attended one almost on a whim, not saying by accident, but of Joe Norman. You know Joe Norman, the complexity guy. And I really enjoyed it, right, actually. Right? I was looking forward to having a class every Tuesday and Thursday. I was taking my kids to school, coming back at 10 a.m. my time. There was a class a couple of times a week and it lasted for 3 months. And I missed it actually when it finished, right? Because there was something intangible. And this goes to show how complex we are as humans, right? I mean, I'm almost 40 years old. I lived all my life believing that I avoid all structure as much as possible, especially with learning, education. Again, like even with working, right? I mean, I don't think I'm the kind of person who would enjoy going to a workshop with an actual person live. I learned from YouTube, trying things, right? Courses and things like that, self-directed. But in this case, I enjoyed it, right? So, and that made me think, then I joined a few others and then I joined yours as well. And so that really came for the inspiration for me to do my own and host my own. And even that I was liking, right? Even though I'm repeating the same thing a lot of times, I mean, it's funny, right? I'm honestly enjoying it. Like, you get a sense of like exhilaration almost every time I finish a class, right? It's crazy. Like, so where do I sit on that? So maybe I was wrong that I completely dislike structure everywhere. There are some context, some situation, where it's actually some structure is enjoyable. Like, this is why I'm a big fan now. I've become a big fan of live classes versus the course. Like, for example, your class about philosophy in the small best community. Why don't we just record it and we just give it to everyone? Because it's not the same thing. Like, for some reason, people enjoy it more if they come and there's like 20 other people there and they ask questions and they see a few faces. Again, it's just human nature, right? This is just something that we can't really change. Like, self-directed is a bit forced, right? It's not forced, like it's a bit against nature, right? You need to be super motivated to go through it, right? It needs to be something that's so intrinsic. But if it's just a philosophy class, it's very hard to be intrinsically motivated about it. We need to get people together, right, to have that. And same thing with Joe Norman's complexity thing, right? I mean, if Joe Norman told me, go read these 4 books and you'll learn everything you need to know, I wouldn't have done it. I might have bought them and they would have sat on my bookshelf forever. But the fact that I showed up, I made a cup of coffee, a big Zoom meeting, right? And there was Joe speaking and giving examples. It was fun, right? I learned, there was a few aha moments. Oh, that's great. Like, these topics about scale and whatever, they're very interesting from a more technical level. And it was an interesting experience, like reflecting myself, my own emotions on how I reacted to that made me realize, you know, this is a very fascinating medium, right? And it's interesting.
Yeah, it's this is a thing. Something similar happens with me as well, because I do dislike structure, but then, and maybe because I do dislike structure, I understand, and I always understood that students might not be intrinsically motivated to take philosophy. I mean, who the hell cares about philosophy, right? Especially at university when I was still teaching undergrads. And that's why I always kind of tried to get them to forget about the grade, to forget about the exams, because maybe what you disliked about structure is, in addition to the fact that you had to be present face to face, but it's like, you know, you have to sit for an exam. You
have the exam and the test
material obsession that you need to read, and then they'll test you for it, and you know it's all pointless because ultimately whatever you learn and your knowledge is cannot be tested this way. Maybe it can for like medicine and other stuff, but when you're talking, I mean, computer science, it's pretty obvious, but then you can know things theoretically and you might graduate. And I know for a fact from like anecdotally, but friends of mine who graduated in computer science and then they couldn't develop anything. Because it was all too theoretical, right? And so unless you're motivated and you want to do that, so I understand that. But maybe in your case and also in my case and in Joe's case, insofar as there is no, there's no kind of the need to sit for exams and grading and readings, maybe you can just show up, enjoy your time, socialize with others, learn one thing or two, that's it. This is what human nature is about. It's not about being tested and testing your know, unless again it's something very important. But it's quite interesting because you did change your opinion on that, and you also recorded a Twitter course, and it was pre-recorded.
That taught me something. Like, I mean, the it was exhausting, even just doing that 1 hour take of the Twitter course. Look, like me speaking with you here, this feels completely natural. Like it's like you're here, it's like feels like a normal human interaction. Me recording myself in front of a camera is completely the opposite for me. Again, this personality, I know people like all the TikTokers or whatever, they feel differently. But for me, it just feels totally bizarre. Like, I remember recording that Twitter course 1 hour. Like, I was so tired. I think I slept for like 10 hours straight immediately afterwards. It was just took all my energy out. And in fact, for the small bets course, I was originally thinking of doing something similar. But then I realized, look, I have like 10 hours of content probably. I thought I'm going to carve out 2 weeks and do it slowly. But I kept putting it off, procrastinating, never wanting to do it because it just felt very strange. And again, like, and I'm sure like the quality of the content wouldn't have been the same as well. Whereas just me starting up a Zoom meeting, a few people show up and I just talk about it, completely different experience. And that's why I'm repeating it. Like in a couple of weeks, I'm going to start the 26th course version. Right? So people sometimes think like, why are you doing this? Why are you repeating it? Why don't you just record it or whatever? But again, it's just, first of all, for me, it feels easy. Honestly, it's easier. I mean, now I've done it so much that I literally just, you know, show up and I can sort of give my presentation with very little effort. And there's the other benefits as well, I think, for the members being there, right? It's, I'm almost certain, right, that like only a small tiny fraction would even go through the entire 10 hours of content if it wasn't live. And you could try to resist this again. Resisting this, it's again like using the metaphor of the palm tree in Alaska. Yes, you know, you could force yourself or try to force your students to join by giving them points or some gamification system or something
at the certificate.
Certificate, yeah, or you can't. They won't be able to fast forward or sending them an email every week. Like something fascinating. Actually, I'm going to jump to attention because again, it's a bit of an inconsistency here. But I took a woodworking course online woodworking course, one of the first one actually, and one of the best ones for beginners. And I signed up and I thought I was going to receive all the content immediately. I paid $70. And this guy had like 7 projects on the landing page. This is what you learn after you take my woodworking course. Like a dining table, like, you know, a box, a few other things. I don't even remember. But there were 7 projects. And then when I signed up, the guy didn't send me anything. Actually, he sent me next Saturday, I'm going to send you the plans and the video to do the first project. And then every weekend, I will send you a new one. It was all automated. Right, to sort of to software. And at first I thought, wow, what I feel ripped off. Like I wanted to just start working on this thing immediately. But then again, to be honest with you, like I was honest with myself, I actually started to enjoy I was looking forward to next Saturday receiving a new piece of content, right? Because I was following I did the bench. That was the first. The first project was actually a work bench for the workshop. Then the next was like a small outdoor bench, and the third was like a picture frame, and the fourth was a coffee table or whatever. And he told you, like, next week is going to be this, and you're going to receive the plans. And he structured it in a way that, like, on a Friday he gives you the material list to go to your to the lumber yard and buy the tools and the material you need, and then on the weekend you work on it. And this made me think, like, I mean, this is interesting. This is very structured, artificially structured, actually, because this is not the guy saying, it's not like it's an in-person workshop and the guy is only there on weekends. This is to software. He has a condition saying, if today is Saturday, send out the next release. But I have to admit with myself that this is what actually was beneficial to me. Right? I think probably I would have been overwhelmed if I received them all at one go. It was enjoyable to receive these. Again, I missed, once they finished, I missed them. I said, in fact, I bought his second course because I wanted another drip of these things, right? So it's funny, like, it's all human psychology. Again, like, it's trying to, I think trying to study our own behavior sometimes probably is the best way to not get fooled by our rational way of thinking things and being reductionist with human nature. We're super complex. So this, and I think this is my point, despite me disliking in general highly structured things and living all my life where I've been very self-directed learner and traditional education mostly failed me because it was very structured work arrangements, the 40-hour work week I tolerated for a bit, but it was almost on the brink of a nervous breakdown. I dislike structure, like, there's a lot of evidence. Nevertheless, I have to recognize that in some instances it works. And I find it enjoyable and it's sort of more effective. Right? So it's even probably the label of structure disliker is probably inadequate. Right? It's a bit more complicated than that.
And this is interesting because I'm now, see, one of the things I'm trying to develop now is some sort of, after these 3 years of tinkering around, and thanks to opportunities like the Small Bets talk on stoicism and uncertainty, I'm trying to develop this course for on philosophy for professionals. But after all these years now, I feel like I'm ready to do this, divide it into three parts. Asking meaningful questions, navigating uncertainty, and then an intro to moral reasoning. So what would be a course divided over three weeks or 4 weeks where we discuss moral reasoning and debate and stuff like that. Now I feel like I'm ready to just, you know, cut the fluff and present it in one session. Because I was thinking, should I do this as a pre-recorded course or should I continue doing this as a workshop if this is what I wanna if this is much better like as a workshop. And I think based on what we're talking now, it's, you're right, like, unless it's less than 2 hours, it would be pointless to create a pre-recorded course, because otherwise no one would finish it. It's too long. Yeah. Then let's see how that goes. And also thanks to the this is going June 27, I think, would be the fifth or sixth iteration. And this is part of what you are talking about, right? Doing this live, even if it's stoicism, the sixth time, everyone, you see how people react, the kind of examples they bring up. So you also adapt and you improve the content based on what sticks, what doesn't, and you keep improving and refining, and then it makes it even more engaging and more helpful to people, etc.
And you can read the room in real time again based on the reactions, comments, questions. You start sensing whether people are getting the message. It's different, right? I agree.
Because when you're pre-recording a course, it's you assume that this is the material that's going to stick. But then it works for things like Twitter, because you're like, okay, I did this and this is how you can maybe grow your audience. Yeah. But then when you're dealing with things like complexity and philosophy and even now Small Bets, it's like, how do you pre-record that? So it's already, you're not telling them you should do this or do that. It's just a journey whereby you're just trying to explain and interact and create this atmosphere between people to see how they can relate to this and whether or not it resonates with them. So I think that, yeah, this is a good approach when it comes to synchronous courses. But do you think this might not be kind of something you thought about, but do you feel like there's Zoom virtual kind of synchronous virtual meetups fatigue?
Look, I maybe, but again, this is something I think that if you're in this game, you will adapt to it, right? I mean, right now people are still signing up, right? Like in our community, Monday, like earlier this week, we started this newsletter course with Louis and Chris, and we had like record turnout, record registration. So my information right now, my signals are that, yeah, maybe there is fatigue, but it's not showing up yet. At some point, if people stop showing up or start seeing the numbers going down, then you adapt. Then maybe we do local meetups physically, right? I mean, we'll just split up based on locations, and once every 6 months we meet up in person. Or maybe it will be over email, even more virtual. Who knows? Or maybe something, right? This goes back to defending for yourself, skill building the muscle type of thing. I don't know what the future is going to look like. And that, again, like this is something that I also dislike about all the, you know, especially in tech, but on Twitter in general, like people trying to predict what's going to happen, the trends and all that nonsense. Like it's futile, right? And potentially harmful, I think, to try to rely on being good at predicting what's going to happen, or even what is happening, right? Because like actually yesterday, I think somebody was semi-viral tweet saying, communities are dead, like they blew up in 2020 and now nobody wants to join any more communities. My community is growing, had a record month, year on year, it's sort of growing every time. Is it? I mean, I don't think there, maybe some of them failed too. Maybe at the collective level, the community economy is shrinking. I have no idea. Possible, right? Maybe there was a big spike after the pandemic, whatever, and now only a few remain. But that information is almost useless to me, right? Or maybe I don't fit as a community label. Who cares? Again, all this boxing and coming up with jargon of trying to articulate and represent things, you know, it's so yeah, like Zoom fatigue is a description of an emotion. Maybe it's happening at a collective level, right? But I put out a Zoom Luma invite, right, and people sign up, and it makes it a sustainable business for now, right? I mean, every month the sales are more than the expenses, and I just keep doing it until at some point, and I am, again, I'm not saying this is going to continue forever, I'm certainly not. When it starts to go down below some threshold, you know, it's negative feedback, right? You're forced to react like a thermostat, right? The temperature is out below 20 degrees. Now you start.
Do you have some sort of goal when it comes to the community? Maybe like hit 1 million revenue or something? After which you would pull the plug? I don't know, but maybe you would think to yourself, like, if I hit that threshold, that's it.
It's another thing I try to not think much about, because again, like, it depends so much on what's happening in the present and that point, right? I mean, honestly, again, like, to me, like, the month, like, again, today is the first of the month. It's an interesting time frame, because I like to think on a month by month basis, right? It's like, okay, this month now it starts from, everything starts from zero, and what should my priority be this month? And you know, try to make the best out of it. No goals. So it's again, I'm mostly driven by the downside. That, I mean, mostly driven by, you know, of course, I wanted, you know, I want to try to not make it fail, right? So that's what I focus on. Like, how can I make sure that people are still enjoying being there and tell their friends about it, right? And new people know about the community and they focus on that and sort of let the upside take care of itself, right? Sort of more trying to get enough attention to just keep it surviving. Again, like this is another thing, maybe there's probably another hour worth of discussion. It's like the focus on survival. I think it's so important and so underrated, right? And this, I think, another attitude that many people miss. And I think it helps me a lot. It's literally almost all my decisions are about what can I do today to extend my survival a little bit more, right? And even though it might seem like another way of looking at things, I think it actually makes you do things differently, right?
This is very interesting because I've been thinking about this in relation to my situation as well, which is even a bit trickier maybe than your situation. But I sometimes feel that when it comes to survival, and you might not even have an answer for that, right? It's just I was trying to reflect on this. There are two ways of handling this precarious situation of adopting this cockroach mindset that you talk about. Mm-hmm. I feel that sometimes you might enter into a frenzy, kind of, trying to survive at all costs, and then you will be blinded by the opportunities that might be presenting themselves to you. You would not be able to distinguish signal from noise. And versus the other kind of whatever it is, the mindset whereby you're reacting to this precarious situation in a way so as you don't end up having a nervous breakdown, right? Because I was in both situations. Like at one point when you don't know where you're heading and you're struggling to survive as though you're, you know, what would the, it's like you're just struggling for trying to find some sort of harbor to not drown, right? That's some sort of stick to hang to, but or versus doing it more in a more calm, serene way, structured, kind of somewhat knowing where to look for other opportunities. Have you ever been in that situation? It's like struggling for your life and then you're drowning, right? Well,
so I think, again, it's probably a case of the dose makes the poison, right? I mean, I think, and similar maybe to our discussion about scale changing things, like extreme stress is probably not that useful, right? So in terms of being able to recover out of it, it can become its own cycle of, like, probably what you're implying, right, of desperation. So I think if you're in an extreme hardship situation, the only priority is to get out of that extreme hardship situation, right? It's just, it can't be, like, of course, you know, surviving here, it's a relative term, of course. Right? I mean, there's a big difference between literally surviving, like you're in a war-torn country and you're getting bombed and you're trying to survive, versus how we're using it ourselves as trying to remain self-employed, for example, right? I think, and again, maybe I'm not getting the question completely, right? But I feel that if the situation is extremely dire and extremely harsh, you know, it's the only problem you have there is like getting out of it, right, as quickly as possible to get to a place where
even if it's harsh, this is the thing. It's like have you sometimes it happens to me, right? Like you feel you want to survive, but then you're just you spiral down in a way such that you don't know what you're doing, kind of, right? So for example, someone who's not happy in their job, they would start sending like 100 CVs daily, just to get out of it. But then they're not really they're not thinking straight. They don't take a step back and try to approach the situation maybe from a different perspective where they would think more maybe strategically about how they're gonna survive. So I feel like there are two kinds of ways of handling these situations and trying to survive. One where you're just like you launch a product, it doesn't work, and then you think of another product, and as this product is not working, you're already thinking about the third thing, and then you're just spending more money and struggling to find the branch, the kind of not drown, etc. Versus a more laid back, informed approach in order to survive, but not to be blindsided by everything around you, kind of.
I suspect it is a problem of people not working backwards from what they truly want, and I think it all boils down again to preferences question. It's like, you know, the example of launching products randomly, trying to throw things at the wall, seeing what sticks, and nothing is working, whatever. I think it's usually a problem of you think you want to have a successful product, right? But maybe what you truly want is to not have a boss and work for yourself and not having to be 9 to 5 and commute to the office or whatever. So the question you should be asking yourself is like, what's the easiest way for me to fulfill that situation? It might not be launching a product. It might be doing freelancing or, you know, taking a part-time job or maybe working, if what you really hate is the commute, right, or whatever, it's maybe you take a remote job and still work for full-time. And I think once you truly understand what you're really doing, things tend to become easier and more clear, right? It's just because, and again, like this is something I experienced myself, and this is what the excessive runway harmed me in. In the beginning, I thought I want to build an ideal business or with my ideal product. I had all these visions that I wanted to fulfill. Then I had a bit of a crisis of anxiety about 6 months in, where I had already, you know, wasted a good part of my savings. I still hadn't had anything that was making me money. And I said to my subconscious was telling me, look, if you keep on this path, there's a good chance that you're going to waste all your savings, you know, months and years pass quickly, and you'll have nothing to show for, and you'll end up having to go back to a full-time job. And then I realized the thing I really don't want is to go back where I left. Like, I don't care about the project I was working on. I don't care about the business or creating this or that. I just want to maintain this kind of lifestyle, right, of working for myself, not being accountable to a boss or working on somebody else's terms and all that stuff. And that immediately made everything more clear, because then I started.
How did you snap out of it? Yeah,
I think the only thing I would give myself credit to is that when I had the sense of anxiety, I didn't just try to hide it or fight it. I gave it the benefit of the doubt. Like I treated it with respect. That it's probably there for a reason. And I think this is a modern world problem of trying to fight all our subconscious negative emotions. Procrastination, anxiety, lack of attention, boredom. Almost all productivity books and all advice that you see is how to fight these things. We like to believe that our subconscious is like a vestigial organ that we can probably just surgically remove, like the appendix, and we'll probably be better off. But I think that's so naive and foolish, right? And, you know, there's this like computer inside of our brain that unfortunately speaks to us in very primitive ways, you know, just keeps you up at night or makes you demotivated, but it's usually there telling you something important. And basically, I think what I snapped out of it because I kept thinking, what would make me not anxious? And I thought, probably if I make some money this month, I remember it was September of 2019. And I thought, if I make some money this month, probably that would improve my anxiety levels. So far, it was almost 7 months or 8 months I had made no money at all. And then I quickly asked myself, what's the easiest way for me to make some money? I signed up to some freelancing sites. Then I went to my phone contact list and I found somebody who might want to hire me for some freelancing work. And eventually the second one worked and I got a small gig. Like, it was 10 hours a month, nothing crazy. But it's made a huge, huge difference in my peace of mind, getting a check and sort of depositing it. And then I knew I could take more hours, I could find another client, I could continue scrolling to my phone list and maybe find somebody else. And made a big difference, right? And suddenly then I started to realize, okay, now I survived September, I actually managed to almost make as much money. Now I'm going to focus on October. And October, then I worked my advice, right? And then I had a project now. I said I want to finish it in a month. And sort of I started doing all these things again, just focusing on survival. And over time, things started again. I kept exercising my risk-taking muscle. I became better at not doing things that are unlikely to work. I got, again, without fooling myself that I know for certain what's going to work or not. Right? So there's still uncertainty, still a game of uncertainty, a game of poker. But you start building this probabilistic knowledge. Probably just like the hunter-gatherer would have. The hunter-gatherer probably wouldn't just start walking randomly.
Exactly.
The
say, yeah, precisely.
It's likely there's going to be food close to the river. Or now it's winter, there's probably going to be more over there. Or yesterday I saw something there, maybe it's more likely that there's going to find something else there. Signals like that, that you don't know for certain, but you keep moving towards them.
Yeah, and the start wrapping it up, I know this question might not make sense, but how does someone who dislikes structure ends up working at Amazon for so many years? So, and gets promoted.
So at first I thought it was going to be temporary. Right? I remember telling my wife, because actually we moved from Malta to Ireland. Both me and we weren't married yet, but we took the plunge. Again, we thought we wanted to try going abroad. And I certainly, for me, it was a temporary thing. Right? I grew up in Malta, small country, like limited professional opportunities. I was interested in tech. I always felt like I'm missing out on big tech. Right? I mean, I used to work with these tools and databases, but I had no idea how these tools and big things are made. So it was more sort of curiosity to see a bit how the sausage is made in a big place. So I went with the attitude, this temporary for me. Eventually, soon, I will maybe spend a couple of years, absorb as much as I can. I wasn't thinking financially back then. You know, my offer back in Ireland wasn't that extraordinary. I thought it was just a knowledge acquisition exercise. But then I got trapped. Right? This is the thing. Like then they promoted me immediately after the first year. Then like a year and a half after, they offered me to move to Seattle. Then they promoted me again. Then my salary like doubled and then tripled. And then I got an offer to go work for another company. And Amazon like matched the offer and beat it. And like suddenly overnight again, like my salary like almost doubled again, even though it was already very high. And they kept telling me, look, you're on the right track. If you keep going here, if you keep growing here, you have a bright future, so much opportunities. Again, recruiters calling you all the time. Like you start feeling like nothing is going to come close to this working for myself if you measure things from a financial perspective, right? So I remember so they used to assign us these mentors, right, to sort of help us in our career path. And my mentor told me, I highly dislike this mentorship structure, but whatever, I had to do it. But I remember my mentor told me, look, at some point, you're very likely going to have a Wikipedia page about you. You're going to invent something so novel that you're going... And I remember leaving the room thinking, it's, you know, that would be nice, like, to have a Wikipedia page. And my mentor basically told me, think about what you want your Wikipedia page to say about you. And sort of I leaned onto it. I kept thinking about it a little bit. But I remember then after like a week or so, at one point I realized, like, who cares? Like, why do I even want a Wikipedia page? And like, what if I don't have a Wikipedia page? And sort of suddenly I said, to hell with it. Like, I don't care. And I felt a sense of liberation of like, I don't want to play this game. Like, I don't care to have a Wikipedia page or whatever, right? I just want to be free, do whatever I want. And because like you get trapped into this idea that you're doing something so big, so important, you're getting paid well, you see that there's even more opportunity in the future. So you're not like you have reached the top, there's even more. And there's all these signals, right, that you're so important, you can have a Wikipedia page, right, you all these badges and prestige, especially here in the Seattle area, right? I mean, Amazon is so concentrated that you go anywhere, like if you show your Amazon badge, you get discounts and you're trusted and all this sort of stuff. It's hard to defeat psychologically. This gets you. Right? This is the golden handcuffs. Like this is part of it. This is what they call them metaphorically. You're handcuffed. You're not really handcuffed, right? But you're handcuffed psychologically with all this stuff. And it took me a while, right? Again, like to snap out of it again, to realize like this is not the path for me. And again, like to summarize it to a pithy statement, I think what made me snap out of it, I looked at all my colleagues, people higher up than me, people in my same level, and I didn't envy anyone's lifestyle. Like I didn't want to be in anyone's situation. Right? Honestly, almost everyone was living a lifestyle that was much worse than I had. Right? And that sort of made me realize, like these were people, yes, they were well paid, right? Diving again, they have two Teslas and a $2 million home and whatever. So nothing, they that was maybe something envious, but everything else, they woke up every day at 6 a.m., left the house before the kids woke up, came home at night tired, they barely see their family, weak as they're always thinking about work. They're always on call, always something happening, always worried, right? Occasionally they steal a week of vacation and they go to Hawaii, but it's so even the vacation is like stressful, right? And they keep doing this over and over and over, right? Until they sort of get their nervous breakdown or whatever. And that was the path I was moving towards. And I was already somewhat there already, right? And I think that was the thing that I realized, like, if I don't quit, I'm going to end up like them, and I'm already becoming them. And that's what I think in that situation, honestly, I think taking the plunge is the most rational thing, right? Because I think, you know, you just realize you're on the wrong path and you just have to just hop off, right? You can't just keep tweaking it. Right? So, but it took me a while. Right? So why did I spend a decade there? Initially, I felt it was temporary, right? First couple of years, I was enjoying it, taking it all as much as I could. Then there were like probably 4 years of thinking of being trapped. And then I think another mistake that I did was, again, thinking that I need to save more to build a better runway. So the last 3 years, I was already there on autopilot mode. Like if they fire me, I'm okay with it. I want to leave, but I was thinking, I want to milk this cow a bit more to improve my bank account situation so that I have a bigger runway. And that also was a mistake. I think I should have left sooner because probably it was unnecessary, right? Beyond a certain point. I'm not saying like if you have nothing, right, just quit immediately. If like you can't pay expenses like next month, but probably beyond like 6 months or whatever, probably would have all been, again, very likely, not just unnecessary, but probably harmful. I think it's easier, again, to feel just like the guy in the weightlifter, thinking all about the safety hinges. That's what I was doing, thinking all about, I have to do this runway, I'm saved so much time. I'm thinking there's always the fallback. I think you want to remember that you wrote off the fallback. You're not going there ever, right? And that puts the fire under you, I think, to actually start seeing the real opportunities, right, and not be too idealistic, not be blinded by these sort of childhood dreams or other nonsense, and just go and make it work. Yeah, you know, it forces you to adapt and to be fit.
This is interesting. It's like at first, yeah, you're learning, then you're trapped, and then it's a vicious kind of cycle.
It's a vicious cycle, exactly.
Yeah. And one last question, which might seem cheeky as well. This is, I don't know how you will, but I don't even know how to articulate this question. How do you feel about being called social media employee?
Look,
if at all, right? But you get no, my, no, no. You get my point.
It's interesting that I think I would be lying if I say that So here's the thing. I'm very careful with the labels I assign to myself. That's why in my Twitter bio and how I introduce myself, I don't even use the terms entrepreneur or content creator or whatever, because these labels to me are meaningless. They mean different things to different people. And me, myself, I want to protect myself from feeling trapped with one label. Like people argue all the time, are you a true entrepreneur? Are you too blah, blah, blah? Like, I don't care. My goal is just, I want to be self-employed. Maybe that's the only label because it's very factual what it means. Right? I'm just, don't have an employer. But you can't control how other people see you, right? So that's the reality, right? And some people think social media employee, thought leader, ex-Amazon, disgruntled employee, like they, depending on what sliver of my story they've seen, they come up with a description like, who is this guy? Oh, he's just a grifter on Twitter. And that's the label they put in their head. And then it's very hard to, and then they see something they disagree with me and they go into Twitter and say, oh, you're just a grifter. You're saying this for the engagement, blah, blah, blah. You're just a troll. It happens. And I sort of started to realize that this is the human behavior. They see something they don't understand. They try to categorize it in their mental database with a label. Oh, this he's just an online troll. And then they try to explain everything with that justification they did. And I think this is just the cost of doing business online. That is just part of the game. I think my lesson from that is for me to try to be careful not to do it on myself, because this is very easy to do. Again, to stick a label to something, to someone, and then it's very hard to change your opinion after the fact, right? And this is what my critics do on me, you know, and I feel sorry for them, just they have the wrong impression, whatever. You know, I don't think you want to be, you know, I don't want myself to fool myself again just because I jumped to a conclusion early and this is how I see things. Because this is how, I think, again, this is how you lose. You create luck blindness, I like to call it. Right? I mean, once you start dismissing everything as, oh, that's just a grifter, or that's just a course creator, he's just a troll on the internet, whatever, then you see everything is bad, like, for you. Like, this is what I thought, you know, Gary Vaynerchuk, Gary V, this is what he inspired me most of, right, is like, he gets all these insults all the time because he's the kind of extroverted motivational speaker. He attracts this kind of criticism, right? Because that's to some people, that's the vibe he gets. But he taught me to see that that all of this just doesn't matter. Right? This is just what people are going to. Some people are going to see you, and the only thing you can control is how you behave. And some people are going to see all your full behavior and sort of understand you, but there's always going to be this part that you know, I'm just going to come up with labels and excuses and whatever, and it's what it is.
Yeah, and you're pushing also the wrong buttons sometimes with Paul responding to your memes, yeah, and stuff like that,
and and I'm planning to elaborate on even more on that, because that goes all into, like, I have this post, it's almost done. It probably goes out in a week or two. It's all back to what we started with. Good for the collective, bad for the individuals. Y Combinator in particular, right? As a startup incubator, venture capitalist type of thing. This is not the kind of, so I'm not against venture capitalists if you see it as a financial instrument, like getting a loan. You know, it's Elon Musk who wants to launch a spaceship company. He goes to venture capitalists that want to partner with him, right, to in this sort of big journey. Great, that's excellent. Y Combinator is different. It's like a school incubator type of program where it lures 20-year-old, mostly boys, men, whatever, they're all full of ambitions of grandeur and whatever, right, into this sort of program, which makes it look like if you go to the Y Combinator website, our formula for success, our growth, our whatever, it's all pictures about what's good for the collective, what's good for the portfolio of Y Combinator. But the reality Like they invested, they enrolled 4,000, I think, people so far in their incubator. Like 2,950 out of those 400 ended up spending years of their prime of their life living in some damp basement in San Francisco with four roommates, living on takeout food, learning things that are not going to be helpful to them if they were to work for themselves. So they will have to unlearn them, which sometimes it's harder to unlearn. And they were sold a false promise. They were duped into believing that's what's good for the economy, for the startup economy, for Silicon Valley is going to be good for them. And in fact, I think it's quite ridiculous that Paul Graham replied to me and say, oh, you're wrong, because look at Stripe. Like, he cherry picked one outlier success from 12 years ago. It wasn't like he told me an example from yesterday. Like, he had to go dig down to find that cherry picked example, like one out of 4,000. And I think it sort of proves my point. Like, I don't know if Paul Graham, like, he's certainly smart. And to be a venture capitalist, successful venture capitalist, I don't think you can be fooled by randomness too easily. You understand that things are more random than they seem, and you need to diversify. And the things that paid off for him are the things that were likely the least one he expected. He talks about this, like Airbnb. He funded it on a whim, like it was just these two kids. He was probably focused on other things. Then this thing blew up, right, and became one of their biggest successes. But then what he's recommending others is not to do like what he does. Like, you should to go all in on AI, pick a spot in the ground and keep digging for buried treasure in that spot. Don't diversify, just keep digging to the center of the earth. Yeah, you might end up digging for eternity. If the treasure is not there, who cares? I have 10,000 others like you digging exactly in different spots. Yeah. Like, you're going to, you, this is wartime behavior. Like, in wartime, we have to agree that we have to sacrifice the individual for the collective. That's the heroism of wartime. You know, the soldier on the battlefield, right? You're literally risking your life for the good of the country, the people back at home, whatever. This is wartime behavior. But in peacetime, this is ridiculous. In peacetime, we should be putting the individual as the goal of capitalism, the individual as the center. And whatever happens to collective is a positive side effect. Not flipping it the other way around. Like, Paul Graham is telling this story as if like he's the general in battle, rallying up the troops to go do on D-Day and fight the Nazis. Yeah, most of you will die, but it's, you know, it's to save the world and to save humanity. Is it really necessary? right now, and especially, you know, he's going after, again, like 22-year-olds, highly impressionable people that will likely waste a decade of their life doing things that they're not really going to help them. Again, that's something that they sell. Like, do you learn life-changing skills and whatever? I think it's what they learn is probably more harmful than helpful, because they learn how to play the Y Combinator game. Like, this, they put them in this kindergarten-like structure, right, where they told you just focus on building, we'll set you up with connections, your goal is to get to the next fundraising round, and blah blah blah. Real business is not like that. Real business is understanding human behavior, seeing what they want,
because it becomes about convincing others to give them money than
exactly to other investors. Yeah. And that's the whole perverse structure, kind of. Right, and again, this the issue is that it's usually hard to unlearn things. Again, there's this human, do we seem to suffer from this problem that once you form an opinion on something, it's very hard to change it. So once you think that the best way to start a business is by doing all these things, right? And like yesterday, like I tweeted about, like people think like, I need to start a Delaware-based C-Corp because what if I sell my business and all this nonsense? No, like if you haven't made a single dollar yet, don't even think about creating shares and infrastructure and all that nonsense. But Y Combinator tells you, before you do anything, before you even have any revenue, you need to set up a Delaware C Corp, because for them to invest in you and for other investors, they need to have this structure. Right? So people learn, this is just one example out of thousands. Like, people learn all these small things that then it becomes a habit, and it becomes easier. It becomes very hard to unlearn if they want to truly work for themselves, right, and fend for on their own.
Yeah.
But so this is my mini rant, like I'm sort of
no, but that, this going is, to go this down. Is, this is
but
this
it ties
is
it all back to the beginning.
Yeah, so yeah, 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 yeah. Exactly. It's like this is where small bets comes in. It's like don't the individual versus the collective kind of idea. What works for the collective might not work for the individual, and vice versa. And context is also important. Like it's insofar as people are aware that this is what they're doing, like putting all their eggs in one basket, at least for those who are participating in the Y Combinator thing. I mean, if they're aware that they need to have several bets, etc., that's good. But then, as you said, many of them end up failing, and then they're just spoiled, and they need to unlearn so many things because they think this is how business is done. Either way, I'm offended because, I mean, he replied to you, but then when I asked him if he read or reads philosophy, he doesn't respond to me. So, yeah. Take that as a compliment in your case. I mean, at least the guy is responding to you. So, yeah. But this was very interesting. I enjoyed this discussion. I am almost sure we can end up having discussing all this for another hour and a half, but let's not extend that beyond I think an hour and a half. I think almost Is there anything else you'd probably add, something you wanted to share but you haven't? And afterwards, where can people find you?
No, I think we covered all the topics that I talk about here. Yeah, and people find me probably at Twitter is the best place. Twitter, dvassallo, dvassallo. I'm there almost daily, you know.
Finding inspiration.
Finding inspiration, too. Like that's my selfish use of Twitter, like looking at what other people are doing to catalyze my brain. But I try to give back by replying to people who have questions, and I try to share a little bit of what I'm figuring out, which I think can be inspiring to other people as well. Right? So
Definitely, it was inspiring to me going all the way back. So,
yeah, and I was inspired by others. Right? So that's one of the nice things of social media that I think it's rarely mentioned. It's not all doom scrolling and politics and whatever.
Exactly, knowing how to use Twitter. So yeah, dvassallo on Twitter. And thank you very much again for doing this. And thank you, everyone, for listening. Cheers.
Thanks, Mahmoud.